Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by, and welcome to the Partners in Health conference call. Today's call is being recorded and is off the record so that the speakers can have a more intimate conversation with you to talk about the work of PIH. I would now like to turn the call over to Leslie Friday, PIH Interim Director of Content. Please go ahead, Leslie.
Thank you, Ebony. This is Leslie Friday, as Ebony mentioned, and I want to welcome everyone to this conference call where I get to sit with my good friend Paul Farmer here, our chief strategist at Partners in Health and co-founder. I also want to welcome all the donors who are calling in joining us today. It's really a pleasure to have you listen. And as everyone knows who's listening, this time of year is a key fundraising moment. And we just really want to thank our current supporters and potential supporters who are listening right now. Without your help, we would not be able to do the work that we do each and every day across the many sites. And in fact, today is Giving Tuesday, so it is a particularly special moment for us. I want to thank everyone who gave today and also to remind those who haven't yet that there's still a chance. And in fact, you can check out on our website, PIH.org, and also on social media, in your email, you will see a possibility to donate, and there's a match currently. So if you get a chance, check that out. But I want to turn over to Paul here and really welcome you. I always look forward to our conversations, and we're eager to get started because we have a lot of people who've submitted some questions beforehand. And they're great. It was kind of hard to choose which ones to go with. But before we do get to people's questions, I'd love to have you talk a little bit about, first off, what you're most looking forward to in the new year, 2019, and if there's any trips or stories you'd like to share with those listening in right now. So, Paul, take it away.
Thank you, Leslie, and thank you all for calling in and for these questions. If I could answer all these questions, I would be a guru, which I don't aspire to be. But I'm looking forward to, I'm looking forward to tomorrow, and next year is going to be terrific. I'm embarrassed that I wasn't calling this Giving Tuesday already, because I think it's really important. The degree to which we're able to make 2019 a terrific year is going to be directly related, as usual, to the kind of resources that we can muster to do this work. The need is, it's not that it's endless, but it is great, and the team is great, too. The people we get to work with, you know, in Haiti, Rwanda, Malawi, Lesotho, Navajo, in the United States, everywhere, the team is great. So that's not the rate-limiting factor. It's really resources. And to me, that means in a beautiful but unequal world, that means getting the message out. It's probably not fashionable to, you know, talk about evangelism, but, you know, getting the message out is critical because, you know, if you've had the experience that I've had in my own country, for example, everywhere I've been on across the country, I've met people who really do care about this mission. And you know, so getting our message out, getting your message out to more and more people is a big part of about why I'm excited about the coming year. There are specifics, and I've since an unexpected engagement in Sierra Leone and Liberia beginning in 2014, it was because of a difficult time, and I know some of you listening in were there at the same time, and certainly before we were, but it was really when Ebola, exploded across those two countries and Guinea that's kind of what brought us into that part of the world. But it's been a great experience. I know that sounds crazy, and Ebola was and is dreadful. It is dreadful now, and the Congo was been for a long time, but it's been a beautiful experience getting to know a part of the world I always wanted to know, and that's Upper West Africa. And I, you know, of course, we We saw a lot of people die of Ebola who should not have died. And you can make the argument that most people who get Ebola should not die. And we made that argument. But we also got to meet a lot of people who survived Ebola and are friends and coworkers to this day. And just to give one example that's on my mind, there was in January of 2015, so we didn't really know it, but the peak of Ebola in Sierra Leone, and again, this is an artificial kind of boundary, right, because that part of Africa is tightly connected, those three countries. But for Sierra Leone, the number of cases was starting to fall, but it didn't feel like that at the time. And I was in a place called Mafoki. And Mafoki, with a lot of people who are friends to this day. But Mafoki, the place that we were sent by the health authorities of Sierra Leone, was actually an abandoned vocational school. And, you know, I was with Byler Berry and Philly Dahl and many others on the day that the Minister of Health said, oh, we'd like you to go to Mafoki. We went, sure, wherever you want. And on the way out the door, we said to Byler Berry, who's a young physician, he's not that young, actually, and a good friend of ours for many years, but really never worked together, we said, where's Mafoki? Where's Port Luke? We had no idea. But when we heard it was an abandoned school, you'd think, who would abandon a school in rural Sierra Leone? It must be pretty bad. And this is also a place where, you know, maybe I'm a little off in terms of latitude, but up to 200 inches of rain a year. So anything gets abandoned, you know, is engulfed by weeds and trees in no time. And sure enough, it was dreadful. But the Sierra Leoneans were there on their own. You know, they didn't have international partners at the time in that particular setting. And so we had a bunch of PIH stalwarts like John Lasher join our Haitian colleagues. You know, the Haitians are anything Partners in Health does.
Yeah.
The Haitians are involved, I'm proud to say. But anyway, I was just thinking about this kid that I met there, and he wasn't a kid that I was really taking care of. His name is Ibrahim, and he was going blind, and or he was actually, I thought, already blind. And I was taking care of a little girl on the bed across from him and a couple of the other kids. They're all kids, and they'd already their Ebola tests were already negative, but they were, some of them were really, really sick and dying. He was not, but he was the cutest kid ever. He was a really affectionate boy, but he couldn't see, and, you know, he was listening, you know, to what was going on. And, you know, last bed on the right, up against the wall. And then, you know, one day he was home. He hadn't died. He'd gone home. And I just thought about that kid year in, year out. And so some of the other friendships formed in those difficult times included this guy who was a driver back then, Ibrahim Ba. It's the same name, a whole bunch of Ibrahims. And Ibrahim Ba, who still works at Partners in Health in some elevated position now, he and I became good friends because the person who was driving, as soon as they saw this place, Mafoki, there were dead bodies on the ground. It smelled like a war zone. He quit the same day. And Ibrahim Ba took his place. So over the years, I've become good friends with Ibrahim Ba, who's you know, who went back to school and is, like I said, he has a terrific job at PIH and a great spokesperson for our cause. Just recently I said, hey, I want you to find this kid, Ibrahim. And so he said, what's his last name? And I said, I don't know. Well, where is he from? I don't know. Just, I know you can find him. We have this network. And sure enough, he went, all I said was Port Loco, somewhere in the district, and he was in the last bed on the right, and I just want to make sure there's nothing we can do about his eyesight. And it's just like PIH, I think, for me to assume that they would succeed and for him to go and look for him with the head of the survivors group. The Muhammad is his name, and a couple of other people, and off they go and found the kid. And just last week, a friend of mine who's a world-class ophthalmologist from Emory was seeing him, you know, in Sierra Leone. And he'd been there before, Steve Yeh, along with our wonderful, only two Sierra Leonean ophthalmologists. You know, and you can imagine, because Ebola can blind you, right? And it's a complication that was known. These people were completely overwhelmed, these two ophthalmologists, and Steve Yeh had worked with them since the beginning of the epidemic. So there they are this week seeing this kid. So I'm keeping my fingers crossed, but that's a good story. I'm meaning that kind of thing happens all the time when you have a network of people concerned about the health and well-being of others. In this case, unfortunately, a child orphaned by Ebola and almost who almost died of it. So we'll see what happens next.
I'm glad, too, that you mentioned our drivers, because I think there are many of the unsung heroes, or you know, at least I think of them as, and amazing, amazing people who are completely dedicated, sometimes former patients as
yeah.
well. So I think that's a wonderful story.
Everywhere we work, you know, we have to get from point A to point B, and, you know, in some of the places we work, the roads are terrible and dangerous, and certainly that's the case in Sierra Leone. But even in Lima, you know, it's just so much traffic and so far to get, to take so long to get across the town. I mean, they are unsung heroes, and we should be singing their praises more. But they're really the, more than anybody, the folks who look after us, especially, again, when we're new to the place.
Mm-hmm. Let's get to some questions here, and I think the first one is from Sally in Kansas, and Sally wants to know, what is your own personal priority for 2019?
First of all, if Sally's listening, I'm sending you a big hug, because I know which Sally this is. I've already said in this that I want to see our work expand. And, you know, I'm just one person among many thousands who, you know, work with this organization. And my day job is as a medical professor, and that's why you're in my office at Harvard Medical
right.
School.
Yeah.
But a personal priority is just to see Partners in Health expand. And there are a number of ways to expand, right, geographically, which, you know, I'm not rooting for that because I think we're working – you know, in South America, North America, you know, the edge of Europe in any case, and obviously in Africa. That's quite a bit of reach. And then there's so many PDH Engage organizations in the United States and usually at universities. And so the geographic expansion is not what I'm talking about. But everywhere we do work, sometimes we talk about the sites, whatever the term may be, in the places where we do direct service delivery work of one sort or another, we can go deeper. And we can make every clinic or hospital or, you know, those tend to be the places that we work, but we can make those teaching hospitals, like the Brigham, where I work in Boston, it's a university hospital, like Mirbalet. So there's more to be done, and you know, living out our mission is really my personal aspiration for 2019. And again, the story that I just thought of because of my communication with colleague, you know, with my ophthalmology colleagues, there's just so many people involved in that story. Again, I mentioned Ibrahim Ba, who was a driver, who had the courage to stick with the job when others were fleeing, but the head of the patient organization, and he's a student, you know. Everyone calls him the chairman because inside the Ebola treatment unit where he was, which was the largest one in the country, really, he started organizing, you know, his fellow patients, who many of them were just terribly ill, to improve the quality of conditions inside, but that included also, you know, patient support groups and talking to each other. Now, that's very much square with the mission of Partners in Health, right, to make preferential options for in healthcare, and to learn while doing it. And, you know, whether you're a patient advocate, a community organizer, a driver, professor of ophthalmology, a manager, a guy like John Lasher, who is a gifted manager, look at the complexity of the team. So I want to see that grow. And you know, I've already said what that involves. And, you know, I intend to do my bit. Is that a...
That's excellent.
Sally, I can't see you, but I hope that's an okay answer.
You can talk to her next time. What are the three most important lessons learned from fighting the Ebola epidemic? And this is from Barry in Boston. You might know a little bit about this because you've been working on a book. So,
well, I have to say, this is the Barry. I think it is, so she knows. That would like be the question I most want to be asked because I've been struggling with this, you know. Struggling, and it's, the struggle is a good thing, right? I mean, you, why wouldn't you want to struggle when you see this, you know, like I said, this kid I mentioned as an afterthought because the other kids were so sick, acutely ill, that by the time this sweet-tempered boy has gone home, again, he has no parents anymore, then it's like you can forget what the lessons are. And you know, it was, in other words, so dramatic. So how is it possible to stand back and think about the lessons learned? And you know, one of them, and I'm going to get to the question of trust, right? Because why was that epidemic so painful, and why were people fleeing, and I'm not going to call it medical care because I don't think that's what they were saying, but there was clearly a trust issue, right? And so that's where I'm going to head to is the, one of the chief lessons. But first there are these, you know, there's more mundane kind of lessons to be learned. So first of all, why those three countries and no others? Because really 99% of all the cases and more than 99% probably of the deaths were all in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and to a lesser extent, Guinea. And one answer is pretty straightforward, and that was war. Because there recently had been a war. Some people think of it as two wars. Really, you know, when you hear about blood diamonds from Sierra Leone financed the Liberian conflict as well. And then you go, why Guinea? Well, where did people go during the war to escape? They went to Guinea. And so that area was profoundly disrupted just recently by war. And is that a lesson? Yeah, it's important to understand the connections between Ebola and conflict. And that's what's going on right now in the Congo, right? So if we didn't know that as one of the lessons, it is one. Another is what happened after the war, because, you know, it may have gone on for 15 years in the region, but what about the 10 years afterwards? Well, I think one of the failures, and acknowledging failures is important, one of the failures was investing in national health systems. Like emergency responses there are emergencies, and obviously this was one of them, but this labeled complex humanitarian disaster sometimes turns attention away from the need for national institutions that can take on problems like, not only like this dreadful epidemic, but the complication I mentioned for this kid, Ibrahim, you know, who unfortunately is definitely lost most of his sight. And so do we call it health system strengthening? I mean, that sounds so boring, right? It makes it sound like it's the province of some policy wonk somewhere. Mm-hmm. And I have suggested elsewhere we should just call it Beyonce or something engaging, right? But it's critically important. And that's one of the lessons is without more investment in health system strengthening, we're going to see lots more of this in that region. And that's really why you're seeing it in the Congo as well. Conflict and a failure to invest in national institutions. I mean, I would contrast both Sierra Leone and Eastern Congo, or to Rwanda, where there has been really substantial investment in building up health systems, national investment.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, Rwanda probably puts more of its public treasury into healthcare delivery than any other country in sub-Saharan Africa. And that's one of the reasons it has such some of the best improvements over the last decade and more.
Mm-hmm.
That's another part of the Ebola lesson. The other one, you know, to get back to trust, one of the things that struck, and again, this is just my, it's an opinion, it's a conviction. Other people have very different experiences of, you know, the Ebola epidemic in West Africa. But what struck me was not that people were superstitious or fleeing modern medical care. It's that there was no modern medical care. And so, you know, if you've grown up in this sort of nothingness in terms of modern medical care, of course you're going to go to, you know, a traditional healer or whatever the term may be. You know, what option did you have? I'm speaking particularly of Sierra Leone and Liberia, you know, in or the far eastern reaches of Guinea, where those three countries come together. You know, there were times in recent history when there were more refugees than natives in that part of Guinea, right? And they were refugees from Liberia and Sierra Leone. So, you know, this idea that people were fleeing modern medical care is false. And some people say, well, what stopped the Ebola epidemic in West Africa? And, you know, sometimes I say the Atlantic Ocean, because as far, when it got in the Far East all the way to the coast, when it slowed down, the other answer, which is a more upbeat answer, is, well, when we finally integrated attempts to control the disease with attempts to take better care of people. Like that kid, Ibrahim, first of all, he shouldn't have lost his parents, because too many people who got sick with Ebola died because they didn't have access to an ICU, right? Speaking of Emory, that's how my friends at Emory ended up in West Africa, because they took care of the Americans, some of the Americans who were airlifted to what? To an ICU. That's what you need. And after that, he shouldn't have been blinded by Ebola. So, you know, when you're in a clinical desert, you know, that's not only how Ebola kills you, it's how it blinds you. And so this kid, you know, I didn't sense that he had any mistrust of us, right? On the contrary. But the mistrust was born of this, you know, epic level of neglect during and after the war. So I know, Barry, that's not anywhere near concision, but, you know, I know you weren't expecting concision from me.
We have another great question from Wendy in Chicago, Illinois. What have you learned from your work around the world helping poor rural areas that could be applied to help the urban poor in cities like Chicago and New York? I think that's...
Hi, Wendy. I feel like my pals are sending in the questions I want to hear. Well, just to choose one and show that I am capable of brevity. Hear that, Barry? You know, community health workers, you know, just going back to the... I mean, we learned this lesson in Central Haiti, but in Rwanda on a national scale, I'm not saying it's easy. I'm just saying the Rwandan public health authorities have been very committed to this community-based care model. If we could take that model and bring it to the urban United States, you know, where... I mean, you know, some of the things we see in even in a super well-resourced, medically resourced city like Boston, if you can work at a great teaching hospital, but once the patient isn't in the hospital, then he or she, if they have any kind of chronic ailment, you know, it's often facing these problems on alone. And by alone, I mean, you know, in the hospital we have the greatest nurses, but how many visiting nurses are they? We have great subspecialist physicians, but how many of them do home visits? We have social workers. They're just as busy as any of the rest of us, clinicians, right? So that link between the hospital, and it doesn't have to be a big tertiary hospital like the Brigham, but any hospital, that link between the hospital and the community is really either absent or weak. And community health workers, as in Rwanda and as in Haiti, community health workers could really improve outcomes, I think, for people in American cities with very complex illnesses. I mean, when you have terrible diabetes and major mental illness and, you know, throw in something else, hypertension or visual loss from diabetes, that is dreadfully difficult to manage. And forget it, you know, again, any one of those problems, just take them out. Say you have bad diabetes and visual problems without mental illness, still very difficult. Take out visual complications. You will have them later, right? So I think we need a lot more attention to community-based care. And, you know, when we say medical home in the jargon in the United States, we still don't mean the home. We're talking about your institution, home institution. I mean, that's not the same as home. And I think that's a lesson that we learned early on, Wendy, and, you know, that I just wish we could apply here. I was making this pitch once in a conference on mental illness, brain injury, epilepsy. This was in Uganda. And I had gone from Rwanda, which is right next door. And I was making a pitch, you know, using our example of managing chronic infectious disease like AIDS, making a pitch for community health program. And, an academic physician from Nigeria, you know, was from big city, university, got up and said, well, you know, Dr. Farmer, you would not make this argument for community health workers in your own country. And I went, oh, no, sir, that's wrong. I make this argument every day I can. We need this even more in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
We have to finance it properly. We have to make sure people paid a dignified wage.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting, too, even more so, because there's more of an individualistic culture here. So I think there's more pockets of people living by themselves without that social support that we can find.
The isolation that, you know, so many people face, including many elderly and frail elderly, the answer to that is not having them schlep into a hospital for something that could be done much more conveniently and comfortably and safer for them at home.
Mm-hmm. This next question comes from Roman in McKinney, Texas. And I think it's kind of cute. If you could go back in time and give advice to yourself right after graduating from Duke, what would you tell young Paul Farmer? You are young Paul, but maybe younger Paul. Also, what was one of the most influential moments in your early career?
Well, I mean, I can answer the second part very easily. For me, far and away the most influential moment in my early life, I don't know, it became a career, right, was Haiti, going to Haiti. And my debt to Haiti is just profound, and still is, as I said. I've learned so much from Haiti and from my Haitian colleagues. So that part's easy. I don't think I would have gotten into Harvard Medical School if not for Haiti, and I just started at that. As for the advice I would give to the young Paul Farmer, like you said, I am young. But, I mean, I can answer that actually pretty easily, too, because, you know, I teach, and so I was teaching Harvard undergraduates this morning. And most medical professors don't do that, teach undergraduates, but I love it. And you know, they let me do it, and I actually teach with my friends who are all involved in Partners in Health. Some of them, and interesting, they're all physician anthropologists, too. So that's pretty special, right? You don't have to have these separate lives, you know. We're in the same department, faculty of medical school. We also are all engaged in Partners in Health work. But afterwards, I had office hours after class, and you know, what I said to them, some of them were only 18, by the way. Some of them were freshmen. I said, you know, what I learned in those early years of failing, right? So, you know, you think, you know, you're going to apply for, I wanted to work in French West Africa. That's 22. First of all, there is no such thing as French West Africa. You'd have thought I figured that out. That's a colonial fiction, right? And I applied for a Fulbright. And I thought, oh, you know, I'll probably get it. I didn't even get an interview, right? And I tell young people that whenever I can, and there are plenty more, I apply to volunteer, free, as volunteers do, at various institutions in Haiti, you know, and was accepted by none of them, which is in a way, you know, how a small group of his forum partners and how. But, you know, you don't tell those stories when you're applying to medical school or trying to write your first book or trying to be a junior professor or whatever, or, you know, trying to make sure, you know, Partners in Health is bigger and better. We should be trying to make sure it's bigger and better, but not because we're comparing ourselves to anybody else. Those lessons of, it's not all a victory narrative. Things are not going to come easy, and you can learn, and these are absurd setbacks, right, compared to what I've described as real setbacks, like for this kid Ibrahim, right? But as a 20-year-old or a 22-year-old at an American university, I think we should, you know, not expect of our students or each other everything to go our way. It doesn't go the right way for a lot of people living in poverty. Why should we be spared? And that's a hard lesson to learn. At least it was for me.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Another question comes from Gail in Newton. And she says, what gives you hope in this crazy world? Or maybe more specifically, what gave you the most hope in 2018 that we're making progress in the fight against the inequities of healthcare in the world?
Hey, Gail, I'm like batting 1,000. Is that the right metaphor? I want all the questions to be from my friend. well, I mentioned, Gail, the example of Rwanda, which is extremely inspiring to me. There was a young woman who just graduated from college in Rwanda who I met in Rwanda. And to go straight from Rwanda, high school in Rwanda, to an American college, that's pretty inspiring. Anyway, she's now applying to med school. And you know, I was just saying to her in the same office hours that Rwanda was, very inspiring to me in 2018 as in previous years. So when I need to think of inspiring things, I just think of what I thought as a 34-year-old American physician in 1994, what I thought would be the fate of Rwanda, which I'm happy to say, and this is after the genocide, so I'm prognosticating failure. Now, fortunately, no one cared what I thought about Rwanda at the time, so I could keep that secret for a long time that I had low expectations on behalf of other people, the Rwandan people, and I'm so happy I was wrong. So that, their inspiring turnaround, like I said, especially over the last 10, 15 years, is something I can draw on. And what I mean by that is the declines in mortality there over the last 10 years have been steeper than any place at any time in human history. And, you know, to come from rock bottom to, you know, to that kind of progress is pretty inspiring. And then just, you know, Gail, to go back to today, you know, I was just meeting with one of my colleagues who's not a physician, but an epidemiologist, and she has worked for years with Partners in Health in Rwanda, Peru, et cetera. Anyway, these people are over my head. Like, I don't understand all the statistics stuff, and she has a PhD in that area, but she works with all of us to help us figure out what means what. And we were talking about something that we haven't seen in over 40 years, and that was new TB drugs. And if you have drug-resistant tuberculosis, and a lot of people I know do, then you're facing, or were facing until recently, a dreadful therapy that's, you know, poorly tolerated, toxic, and, you know, the outcomes are treatment, and most people would get cured if they can survive the treatment, right? In fact, the word chemotherapy really comes from tuberculosis, not cancer. But now we've got these new drugs, and a couple of them, three new drugs, they're all oral. And that's a big deal. And so right now, Partners in Health and two other organizations, one the largest medical humanitarian organization in the world, Doctors Without Borders, are involved in a huge multi-country study of new TB treatments. In 2018, that to me, and this is funded by Unitaid, another thing that didn't exist, it's a funding mechanism set up by taxing airline travel, like $2 a ticket. Now, not every country signed on to it, but enough did so that they've been able to really bankroll the largest study of new tuberculosis drugs in decades, and Partners in Health is a lead player, along with, 15, 20 ministries of health, that is local health authorities. So, on a national level, look at Rwanda. On a drug level, look at a drug like bedaquiline. And is this going to change the way we treat tuberculosis? Oh, I think it will. And I think it will save a lot of lives, but also prevent some of the horrible suffering we've seen among those who fight to survive by taking this treatment.
Yeah, I think that's a great mention too, Paul, because people no longer have to have daily injections in some of these trials, which is horrendous to think about for 9 months to have an injection.
I've given people injections for a lot longer than 9 months, and this is intramuscular injections. So if you were going to have that here, you would have a central line put in, and, you know, it would go directly, basically, into your heart, right? And you, when you infuse medications, you wouldn't feel it, right? But for one of those drugs, you can't give it that way. And for the others, we just didn't have the confidence that we could keep those lines free of infection. So these people chose to endure this horrible daily intramuscular injection. And, 9 months is bad enough, but some desperate cases, meaning where they had very few options, received a lot longer than 9 months of therapy. And, I always thought, when I was taking care of a lot of those patients, and I still sometimes think this, there's just no way that this person can take another day of this. And they're going to want to give up. And then they almost never would. Once in a while, I'd be like, could I have one day off a week, And it was just so inspiring,
Mm-hmm.
But we hated those regimens, of course, because they were so painful for them. Mm-hmm. So to have an all-oral, shorter regimen, that's reason enough to be optimistic.
Right. And if I'm not misspeaking, but it's changing the WHO guidelines as well. Right?
Yeah, this summer.
The examples that we've provided have made not just a national, but an international.
And one of the exciting things about this effort is that it's also a study, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when you look at a new cancer chemotherapy regimen, right, you're very often at a place like where we are here at the Brigham, the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, you're often part of a study, right, to see does this new combination work? And that's another thing that this team is able to do. They're also able to use variations. And that's why, of course, I was meeting with this, young epidemiologist. She's already been working with Partners in Health for over a decade.
Okay. Right.
So this was Molly Frankie.
Oh, sure.
Meche and several people have, Partners in Health folks have been architects of a lot of this work and have driven forward our understanding of the epidemics, but also our understands how to clinically respond.
Okay. We have time for another question, I think. So let's see. We'll go with William in Denver. What opportunities do you see for further strengthening PIH's role in promoting the intersection of health and economic prosperity among the communities you serve?
That's a great question. I think about it every day, actually. And one of the biggest problems, I think, is that we pit investments in a social good like healthcare, education, against economic development. And that's a huge mistake. And so that one of the biggest challenges for us is to say, no, that's not how it works. Look at the Rwandan example, right? Rwanda is a poor country, and why would they put 20% of their public budget into healthcare delivery? And the answer is because the leadership understood that that's how to break that cycle of poverty and disease, not to pit economic growth against investments in healthcare and education, not to pit, gender equity in political representation against services for poor women and their children. So, to William Fisherman, I think one of the biggest obstacles we face is pitting one necessary thing against another. It's just grotesque in, when you're really in a setting of extreme poverty and you find, folks from outside, meaning not native to that poverty, saying, well, why should you be taking care of someone with an acute heart attack when they don't even have enough to eat? That kind of question I hear with an undertone of hostility, right? Saying, the only reason I'm doing it is because I'm a doctor and trained to do it, but I also think they should eat. And it's like, why should we be worrying about treating AIDS when we have so much airborne TB? Why should we focus on clinical delivery when we should focus on girls' literacy? What kind of cockamamie ideology would have us pitting one necessary thing against the other? I think that has been our biggest struggle, and I think we're breaking through. Jim Kim is at the head of the World Bank.
Mm-hmm. A co-founder of PIH.
And a co-founder of PIH. I know how he feels about this because we've been talking about it for 35 years. But I think more and more you meet, enlightened folks in all walks of life, including in government and high office, saying, no, we're not going to pit our investments in health care delivery and in higher ed or any kind of ed against economic growth. Because without a healthy population and a literate one, you're just not going to break that cycle of poverty and disease.
Mm-hmm. The last question here. I lied.
I love questions.
Okay. So this one.
Do I look like I'm not having fun?
You always look like you're having fun, Paul. That's what I love. So this last one is from Antonella in Seattle, Washington. And I think something that's quite pertinent. Nowadays, climate change is already impacting weather, the water cycle, and farming. And this will have a strong impact on the health of most people on the planet, especially the poor. What are your thoughts on how to think about climate justice and its impact on global health?
Well, one of the disturbing things has been that I don't really think that there's been that much scientific question for decades. This is not my field, but from what I read as a layperson, there's really little doubt that human activity has been causing climate change, little doubt, for decades. And if you have lived and worked in Haiti, and you see the impact of, I don't even like talking about the earthquake, and this is one of the few times where it hasn't come up,
mm-hmm.
but the earthquake, the storms that preceded it, the hurricanes that preceded it 2 years previously, and afterwards, recently with Hurricane Matthew, there's not a lot of doubt that, the poor are impacted by extreme weather more than others, or in in Sierra Leone. I mean, the mudslides of a couple of years ago, I think you talked about that last one of the earlier times we were on. You know, of course, these are caused by human behavior, and they, meaning it may be the settlement of a steep hillside, it may be deforestation, but there's not a lot of questions. So getting to the heart of Antonella's question, you know, climate justice is a reassuring term because, you know, if you look back at the environmental movement, the environmental movement hasn't always been a social justice movement, right? And it should be. So I'm hijacking somebody else's expression, but, you know, the environmental movement needs to get on the social justice bus, right? Because then we see, you know, how that fight is a fight on behalf of people living in poverty, and all of us as well. You know, you don't need to be from Florida to understand that. I mentioned that because I am.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's been, you know, one of the most exciting things about the environmental movement is it is a social justice movement. And I think we should just embrace that. It's not just out of self-preservation or self-interest, right? You know, is my condo going to be drowned? It's really, you know, it's the only planet we have, and, you know, the, you know, profound destruction already caused has to be reversed. And I think just making it clear that this is not out of enlightened self-interest alone, but out of a concern for, particularly the most vulnerable, and again, that overlaps entirely with the preferential options of the poor in healthcare. And, you know, so I think, you know, that gives me hope. And I know that there are people who are very discouraged and don't see hope at the end of this, but I think we, you know, that's not the best way to proceed. Proceed as if we can make a difference and all pull together.
Mm-hmm. I want to thank you, Paul, for your chat today. It's always fun to talk to you. I feel like I learn something new every time. I know I do. And I think everyone else listening to you on the line feels the same way. So thanks to everyone who has been listening this hour. And I just want to remind anyone who would like more information about Partners in Health work to definitely visit CIH.org.
It's Giving Tuesday.
It's Giving Tuesday.
I'm in.
You are in. You're a supporter long-term, and you guys listening can be too. So
my mother says she's the original PIA.
And she's great. She's a Facebook fan, by the way. She's wonderful. So check out the website, PIH.org, or Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Look at your email. I'm sure you get some messages, too, from us as well. But thank you, and please remember, if you can,
join PIH Engage, too.
Join PIH Engage and give on Giving Tuesday. And thank you, because I know many of you already have. And we look forward to the next conversation.
Amen.
And this does conclude today's call. Thank you for your participation. You may now disconnect.